Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. March 1st, 2018, episode 126, Hard-Headed. Hello, everyone, and welcome. March 1st. Can you believe it? March is here already. January and February were simply a blur this year. Actually, things are a bit blurry today, as you'll hear, but that's a different topic. To me, beekeeping starts in earnest when the crocus pop, the crocus flowers, and I see bees foraging. That occurred earlier this week. Crocus and snowdrops are the first indicator plants for us in our local space, and they came into bloom over the last few days. I'm recording this today as one of our last activities before turning in and prepping for departure in the morning to Africa. Tim Schuler, our trusted leader for the next week and few days, has already made it to Africa and is getting activities prepped for us to take on while we arrive. There was some discussion about going to do some live coverage back to the U.S. while we are there. But my guess is things are going to be a bit fluid as we are going to be somewhat remote and our day-to-day activities are pretty unplanned. If I could find some bandwidth, my intention is to do a few Facebook live reports back. But again, I can't say I can commit to it because I simply don't know if that's even feasible. If, for whatever reason, you wanted to try and catch it, it would be at facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. So let me take a moment and give some insight as to what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to share what happened yesterday. I had what you might call an incident, and some of my pleasure of living is that I am here today to record this and have all my faculties, at least I hope I've retained them all. So I'm not sure I had any to spare. I want to follow up on some of the 2018 notions and call out a specific topic, my plans for bottom boards and my Langstroth hives. I've been watching Randy Oliver with interest, perhaps not as closely as I should, but actually he's where I thought he would be in the shop towel approach, and I'm going to talk about that in a bit. I'm planning to purchase a new beekeeping jacket for the 2018 season. I have an idea, and I'll share some thoughts about jacket shopping. I've been to the normal run of the meetings leading up to spring here in the Northeast. The Berks meeting, the Philly Guild, an RVBA monthly, the NJBA winter meeting, and most recently our second Northwest meeting of the year. Most of the topics covered in these things are seasonal, but some are not. Plan to give a recap of a few odds and ends and impressions from recent ones. Given my bias toward podcasting and being a budding vlogger, I really thought I would do something different on my trip to Africa and try my hand at a pseudo-documentary. I'm not sure what my narrative is, but I went as far as propping a list of video shots, and I want to see if I can get them while I'm in country. What video shots? A person walking on a path, water and rain, or looking out a window at fields passing by while driving down the road. And of course, you know, beekeeping activities. That's what we're going for and we'll partake in. My hope is to tell the story of not us, but them. I'm keeping an open mind because, as I said, things are supposed to be fluid, and I cannot plan or even know what I can or cannot shoot. When you don't know, what you might do is overpack, and that's what I've done. I'll explain that when I get to that segment. So there's a lot there, and it's all that I could probably squeeze in this episode, so we'll see where it takes us today. Let's get it all started to the local hive report. For this local hive report, it's still going to be somewhat brief. It's still cool to do anything meaningful in the way of hive work. I've asked myself recently if I was being too conservative on this idea, and take solace that in a recent revisit of a talk from Landy Simone last year, I heard her share that she does not consider opening her hives for any tasks other than emergency work until the 1st of March. For all my talk about doing an early treatment of my hives, I've been all talk and no action. Well, as I've shared in the past episode, I bought Apivar, but it requires me to deconstruct my boxes, and while we had one warm 50-degree day here, that's 10 degrees for our Celsius friends, I didn't have the heart to crack open my boxes. My instinct was right, as the lows at night for the past 2 weeks have been in the 30s, and we've had cool days. Now, we had one record-setting 78-degree day last week, but it was followed by a significant drop in temperature, and, oh, I was at work that day. Anyway, it looks like this year will net out 6 out of 12 hives coming through. The one split that I made last year from my 8-frame hive, and the split from the poly hive and subsequent walkaway that I did on that, all did not make it. These have one thing in common, in that each of these hives were treated in the summer with my 2017 mistake, Apivar from an open package. I knew post the treatment after doing mite washes that my mite loads were high on these hives, and I tried to recover late with oxalic vaporizations, but it goes to demonstrate that you cannot treat late and expect a hive to survive. One nuke did make it through, but the other did not. I thought it might be done, the one that survived a few weeks ago, as it didn't see any signs of life on a warm day. But I did something that proved to me, without opening the hive, and assured me that the hive was alive, or at least provided me with indications, and let me share. I looked at that hive at some point in January, and there did not seem to be an indication from the FLIR camera that the hive was alive. Now, these hives are insulated, so the only thing I could do was shoot the entrance. And the right side showed no indication, and the left one showed just a faint glimmer of something going on, but it could have been a false positive, and I wasn't confident. I looked at the entrances of both bottom boards at that time and saw remnants of house cleaning, meaning when the hives were alive, there was evidence of undertaker bees taking out dead bees. In the winter, they sometimes only get as far as the front entrance and do not literally take the dead bees away. I cleaned off the entrances and made a mental note to take note of what it looked like upon return. When I looked at the one on the right, it was still clean, which is not a good sign, but the one on the left had some telltale bees on the entrance after that 78-degree day that I mentioned. I pulled some insulation off the top of that hive on a warm afternoon and opened the lid. I could feel the slightest traces of warmth and smell the odors of an operating hive. If you open a dead hive in the winter and you get no smell, you probably know what you have. You want to smell that warm, waxy feeling, and on a cool, crisp day, it comes through really cleanly. As soon as I lifted the hive, even just a few inches, I knew that that hive was alive and I put it back down. And then subsequently on warmer days, I've seen bees coming and going with pollen, which is another sure sign that a hive is alive these days. Robber bees do not bring pollen with them when they are raiding, so a hive, if you want to know whether a hive is alive or not, being robbed or fed, just look for pollen going in. It's a good sign if they're bringing in pollen that they're feeding young brood. Anyway, it was 38 degrees this morning when I woke up, and we are just getting those days where we are going to see some 50-degree days in the afternoon, and spring is really going to come in earnest here. When I get back, I'm looking to putting on those light flannel shirts, having those days out in the garage where I'm doing my finish-up preparatory steps for getting the operation up and running again. The local hive report, check. Let's go ahead and move to topic number one. Topic number one, I call this one down for the count. Yesterday, As you'll hear, I had a bit of an incident. A day later, I'm sharing my conversation with Sharon as we took a breath and recounted what had happened while I was sitting in an emergency room bed. Before I play this, I will say to you, please take the time today to say hello and share your love with your loved ones. So only I would go this route, but sitting here, it's what, February 28th, 11:11 a.m., in the emergency room, and I'm in preparation for Malawi. I was changing the batteries out on the security camera and had a little incident. And Sharon, you're going to tell me what happened to me.
Because you don't remember anything.
I don't remember. So I know the basics. I do remember I was stepping up onto the support post that holds the basketball hoop where the camera is to grab the camera so I could change the batteries. What's funny is when I walked past it, I went back to it to get it, and I remember the step up. And then the next thing I don't remember, or I do remember, was sitting on the couch, and you had told me you called an ambulance. So fill in a gap. What happened in between?
Well, I was in the house eating breakfast, and I kept hearing the security camera going off, going off, going off, and it's motion censored, so I knew you were playing with them since you've been checking the batteries and stuff like that the past couple days. And the dog started barking like crazy, and I said, why is she still barking? She knew you were coming in, I think, but she's barking like mad. Anyway, the dog was barking like crazy, and I went to check on you, and there you are, stumbling up the driveway. You tripped coming up the steps, and they're real short steps, like 4-inch step-ups. And you told me I was knocked out. I was lying in the mud. And I looked down, and I saw the pole, the whole basketball pole laying on the ground. I said, oh, boy. And you were...
I don't remember
any of that. You kept saying the same thing over and over. I don't know what happened. What happened? What was I doing? I don't know what happened. You kept saying it over and over again. I said, oh, geez, you got a head injury. I could tell. And sure enough, you have a big lump on your head with a scrape.
I'm feeling it right now. It's not swollen up. Are you feeling any?
Right here.
Yeah.
I feel it. It's warm.
Feels good with your hand.
A little bit of
cold.
An abrasion. And so I said, you need to go to the hospital to be checked, to the emergency room.
I don't remember any of this.
I know. You were loopy. You kept saying things over and over. And that's how I knew something was really wrong. So I said, I have to go get changed out of my sweatpants to put jeans on. And you went up before me and... You changed as well.
We had just gone for a walk, so I was wearing sweatpants,
yeah,
and I'm wearing jeans now.
And
I was wearing a red Microsoft T-shirt, and I don't remember putting them on.
You went upstairs and changed into jeans. You were all completely muddy. You're all covered in mud. Your coat, your sweatpants. So I guess you knew to change. So you changed and... You came back downstairs, and I got you some ice for your head.
I put fresh underwear on.
You did. You did. I was surprised, and you kept saying...
So we looked at the video
camera. I don't know what
camera.
I was doing. What was I doing?
And it shows that I got clunked on the head at 7:25.
Yep.
And I emerged from under the rubble at 7:28. So I guess I was unconscious for 3 minutes?
Yep, I guess... Rolling in the mud or something.
It's a heck of a morning.
And the funny thing about the camera is you lifted the whole pole off of you as you tried to get up.
I still had the camera in my hand.
Yes, you brought it in with you.
I did.
Yep.
So
put it on the counter.
Walking through.
Yep.
You see me. Well, the other camera
stumbled
caught me walking to the house.
Yeah.
But that camera has a picture of me walking back to the house as it kept tripping.
And so I was going to drive you myself to the hospital, but you were so loopy acting that I was afraid you'd, like, fall down. I wouldn't be able to get you back up or something. So called 911 and...
Well, I recognized Joe Nanarangelo when he came in.
Yeah, you were getting... You slowly improved as time went on. with the loopiness. Being out of, really, you were really out of it. You got your bell rung, that's for sure. Well,
so Kevin moment. I feel good right now. I have a touch of a headache, but and my, I guess I fell on my left shoulder because my left shoulder hurts. I know that's going to be bruised. My right shoulder, you said my, no, my left shoulder hurts.
Okay.
I think both of my shoulders hurt,
I
but especially
both,
my left.
I think complained of this one earlier.
Yeah, right there where you just touched the
yeah.
back. Well, anyway, that's an interesting start of the morning. Guess I don't have to go to work
you, I asked you some things, and you knew your name, and you knew it was Wednesday. You weren't sure of the month, and you didn't know who the president was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you started to say Obama.
Wow.
But then you stopped. And then you said, who's the president? And I said, Trump.
Did I say, oh, yeah?
No, you just looked at me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
I said, where are you going in 2 days?
They did an MRI. No, a CAT scan.
You said, I said, where are you going in 2 days?
What did I say?
And you said, I don't know.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes. Yes. You were out of it.
Yeah. Well, I'm okay now. They checked my neck. They checked the CAT scan. They said I'm okay.
X-rays, CAT scan, no bleeding in the brain. I guess the neck is okay. That's just precaution, I'm sure.
So the doctor said that I might have headaches or be a little... What was
dizzy,
the,
lightheaded
yeah,
kind of thing.
Vertigo is the word he used over the next 2 weeks, which is great.
You know, while you're in Africa, yeah,
but,
on the plane.
But I should be okay to go to Africa.
Yes,
so.
Thank goodness.
Well, that's an exciting start of the morning.
Never a dull moment, my dear.
Never a dull moment.
Life is precious.
No doubt. It's no laughing matter, but us Englands have a funny candor about us. We laugh out loud in stressful situations. I'm guessing I will experience a persistent headache and after effects for a few days. And I've been taking it easy today. No joke, yesterday was tough. I had a terrible headache all day long. I haven't taken Tylenol in years, and I took 2 Tylenol last night before I went to bed because my head was pounding. When I woke up this morning, I felt pretty good. I haven't taken anything yet. I'm not a medication taker. I do take my vitamins, but that's about the extent of it. Needless to say, I'm sure I'm going to take some Tylenol with me as I go, but recording the podcast is the most strenuous activity I have planned for this evening and today, save for a few things I had to do for work before I left. Anyway, I will say it again. At any moment, things can happen, and I feel fortunate that while this was certainly serious, I am here today, and indeed it is a blessing. I have to share, and this is a bit squeamish, that when I went to bed last night, I was waiting to wake up in the morning. You have those thoughts that run through your head. You have to go through all the scenarios. I was confident I was going to wake up, but you never know, especially after, and if you've watched This Is Us and the episode, which I won't give away. Anyway, now on to some less troublesome experiences. Let's talk about bottom board choices and go ahead to the next topic. Topic number 2, screen bottom board revisit. So screen bottom boards are something that one uses for mites and to some respects ventilation. Mites fall through and do not get back onto the bees. Secondarily, it is an aid in high ventilation. Ask anyone why they use screen bottom boards, and as a rule, they'll share that these two pieces of information are the background of that. I say true, but in practice, I've come to know a few things or hear from others about bottom boards that make me have a different impression. As much as I love the idea of mites falling through, I think the trade-off of high ventilation is not a reasonable way to go. What I mean by that is, when we started keeping bees 10 years ago, we bought screen bottom boards, and sometimes we came by solid bottom boards through different acquisitions, And eventually we have a hodgepodge of bottom boards that have differences here and there. I have some that are a full stand, and then they have these really deep sides, and they're screened with slots to insert coroplast. And I have simple four boards and a screen bottom board with no coroplast inside. I also have traditional beefy solid bottom boards made of real wood and so on. Wait, back up a second, Kevin moment. What exactly is a hodgepodge of something? Of course, I'm going to tell you because I just had a squirrel moment. Squirrel, and I had to know the origin of that. Hodgepodge is a heterogeneous mixture, a jumble. It has its origin in the French cooking technique of making stew, something to do with shaking, presumably the ingredients together, I guess. Okay, curiosity satisfied. Back to our regularly scheduled program. In 2018, one of my objectives is to revisit my bottom board approach and improve and simplify the situation. By the way of an Alan Hayes talk last year, I came to know of a bottom board approach shared by Jamie Ellis from the year 2000, of all things, called the Beltsville Screen Insert. I don't remember what Alan presented that day, but I remembered that name. And I'm going to speculate that this is the USDA-sponsored article from back in that day that may have something to do with bottom boards that we use today and why we switched from a solid bottom board, which I'm guessing from the days of yore was the standard, to screen bottom boards being something you could find in a catalog. I could be completely wrong and say that this Beltsville thing was a similar design and not quite what we see in the catalogs today, but I digress. The reason I share this little tidbit is that in my review of the topic, the concepts of the USDA came up with ideas that are more aligned to my objectives, which I'll get to in a second. Beltsville screen insert works in this way. Quote, separates the mites from the bees by creating a 1.5-inch gap between the bottom board and hive bottom. When bees groom each other, they sometimes knock off the mites. Smoke and chemical treatments applied by beekeepers also help to remove the mites. The insert's wire mesh allows the mites to fall through the screen and onto the hive bottom, so that the mites can't reattach to the bees as they enter and leave the colony. After taking monthly samples of fallen varroa, it was found that this screen reduces varroa populations by 15%. End quote. That means screen bottom boards are a passive way to do mite control, and I think they're often forgotten in the guise of considering integrated pest management techniques, meaning without chemicals. I found the article, of course, that explains what one is, but after fruitless searching for quite a while, I gave up on getting a photo of one to be described. There's an image of Jeff Pettis holding something, but darn if I could make out what it is in that article from 2000. In reviewing the description, it's not hard to fathom what this thing is, though. It's sort of a solid bottom board with a screen above. I had seen something like this in the past, too. The University of Guelph had a design, one that I know a beekeeper named Janice near me uses, that's akin to a solid bottom board that is modified with something that looks a bit like an inner cover, but instead of a solid center, it has a screen. They show a diagram, and I'll have a link to the Guelph diagram in the show notes, of what one looks like and how they build it in Guelph. The reason I recognize the board is that in one of the descriptions it shows a tray with a sticky board that slides between a gap of the solid bottom board on the bottom and the screen that sits above it. Janice shared with me that this is how she gets a sense of how her mite program is working. She routinely places the tray under the screen at certain periods of the year for a prescribed amount of time, and then she assesses her mite drops. I'll tell you all of this so I can come back to my objective for 2018. I have metal mouse guards on my hives that run the full width of the opening. I use these in the colder months, and they work great, but I have one problem. I cannot access easily the inside of the inner cover to do oxalic acid vaporization treatments, meaning I can't slide my OAV vaporizer in the hive because they're blocked off with these metal guards. I need to make an adjustment as I wish to use AOV treatments as part of my routine. I thought about switching to different mouse guards that have a slider that allow me open, but I think this is a better idea. So what to do? What if I stack a screen bottom board over a solid bottom board? What does that buy me? It buys me the same thing as the Guelph board, but I can ensure that I have a big enough gap for inserting my OAV device at the bottom of the hive. And I can also procure some trays and work the same approach as Janice at assessing my mite drops. The bad news for me, last year, I went through my inventory of bottom boards and converted them all to solid bottom boards by closing all the screen ones off. I was so emphatic about this that I used nails instead of screws. If you know me, I use screws for just about everything. When I return from Africa, I'm going to sort through my inventory of bottom boards and get my screen bottom boards back to original form, and then stack a screen over a solid on any of the Langstroth hives I have in the yard. This will set me up for my operation and allow me at any point when I do mite checks to do oxalic acid vaporization treatments if the mood moves me. So I guess I should not move along without saying something about why I closed off my screen bottom boards. It's a preference and a practice thing. I'd been using screen bottom boards during warmer months, but simply did not like the coroplast insert designed to close them off when it gets colder. With multiple bottom board designs, the coroplast inserts varied, which means I had different sizes and it was hard to keep the right insert with the right board, and I simply didn't think they provided the same level of control for the bees temperature-wise when they sealed the hive as a solid bottom board. You know, in time they become warped, they don't fit, you put the wrong size one, there's gaps. It's just a mess. It's not a good situation. If you go back to the frame game of using one equipment supplier, the same applies for bottom boards. The little gaps and such, there's no ways for the bees to close them off because they're underneath the screen. And quite frankly, they were a hassle. You'd forget to put an insert in, and your bees would be freezing. I did the extra work every year to swap out screen ones for solid each fall. And I just want to simplify that, so I closed them all off and made them all solid boards. Are screen bottom boards bad? No. Yet there's some weaknesses that I have come to see over the years of using them, and I made a command decision to just switch and give up that 15% benefit. Why would I do that, though? I really want to get as chemical-free as I can. And I'm giving up a 15% benefit, and I need to rethink that. In fact, I would not call bottom boards a gimmick or dissuade anyone from using them. Any single mite that falls through to its peril is a job well done. But to me, the ability for the bees to control temperatures inside the hive seems to outweigh those benefits. Now, actually, I can somewhat have the best of both worlds. It does require me to use two pieces of equipment instead of one, but I can leave a tray in the bottom sprayed with Pam and get those suckers. And I'm, of course, going to have to figure out how to close off that little chamber underneath for the winter, but I'm thinking that's not overly complicated. It's like having your cake and eating it too. If you look at our show notes for this episode, episode 126, at www.bkcorner.org. I'll have a link to the article about the Beltsville screen insert and a link to the University of Guelph's bottom board design, the screen bottom board. Topic number three, I call this one, it's a breeze. Over our years of beekeeping, we have accumulated a number of beekeeping protective garments. We started with some canvas jackets, and along the way I discovered the new, at that time, mesh suits when they were first introduced. The jackets that I have are too big. At this time, 2 years ago, I did an assessment of what I had after losing some weight, and I decided I needed to buy a new jacket that was a little smaller. I saw something at a beekeeping show and made an impulse purchase by picking up a new style ventilated jacket, but more on this in a moment. Then that year I was in Italy, and I fell in love with the yellow canvas jackets and veil that they have, and I still love that jacket, but in evaluating what we have for the 2018 season, I'm still unsatisfied. So looking what I have in the closet at this point. First, I'll start with the Italy jacket. I liked the jacket, but I didn't understand what the person who was selling it to me said about the size. They gave me a 2X and it's too big. It's probably a 3X in US size. It's just huge. There are times when this is an advantage, like when it's cool and you have a light sweatshirt underneath. So I use it on occasion and plan to keep it. But it's not something I would wear routinely. That thing came as a jacket and matching veil combo. And the veil, by far, is my favorite. In fact, that's what I'm taking to Africa. But the assessment of the jacket is it's just too big. Back in the beginning, when they were released, I bought an Ultra Breeze suit. I followed what was, before the ages of Kickstarter, a conversation on BeeSource and bought one of the first runs ever created. I love that jacket, but sadly, like I said, it's just too big at this point. I could still use it in certain situations and will always treasure it, but I want to scale back in size because it's just too bulky for me now. The other ones, like I said, when we first started out, we bought a couple Manlake canvas jackets, and they're really good, but holy cow, are they hot in the summertime. Once you've worn a breeze jacket, you really don't want to use those. They have their use in early spring when it's cool and in the fall, and occasionally if you want to suck it up and go through the sauna situation, you could try a canvas jacket. That's the way I feel about them now. And let me come back to the ventilated one I bought. I'll say that it's from Brushy Mountain. Nothing against them. Everybody sells these things. It just happened to be that I bought this one from them. That's the one jacket I have that fits. It's the impromptu purchase that I mentioned a moment ago. The jacket's the right size, but I simply don't like it. Sorry to say. It's not about the shape, it's the material. The jacket's made of this foamy style material, and it's a different design from the Ultra Breeze three-layer mesh suits that you'll see in a catalog. The best I could describe this jacket is that it's a foam material with perforations. It does breathe, but not nearly as effective as the ventilated suits. It's less bulky, but there's this certain inflexibility that I do not like. The best way I could describe the materials, it kind of reminds me of can koozie material. You know, the stuff that you put around your soda can or your beverage to keep it cold? The foaminess of it is off-putting. It is light. It does breathe. Kinda. And as a utility, it works, but I just simply don't like it. That's all there is to it. So I pack that in my bag to go to Africa, and I'm going to leave it there. And when I do, I'm back in the position where I need a replacement. So I want a mesh suit and not something else. The mesh suits, as far as I'm concerned, are the innovation. And I scan the choices out there, And I'm going to share with you a little bit of what I found. So suits ranged in dollar amounts from $55 to $119. And there's one special one for $189, which I'll explain in a minute. Let me go ahead and give you a rundown of these. The first one is from B Pro. Found it on eBay. That's the first question. Will you buy something from eBay? I've had pretty good luck with this, actually. The second one is from Glory B, $63. Then I found this suit called a Cool Shield, $80, regular, custombsuits.com. There's the Eco Keeper suit at $99. And then you get into the big guys, Manlake, Dadont. They're around $100. Dadont sells two of them. One of them's an economy jacket, and the other one's a ventilated jacket. Best I could tell, the difference is in the veil. The economy has a telescoping, and the ventilated one has a hat-style one. Then there's another one, which is a Cool Shield, sold by SwarmCommander.com. So in that concept, I guess Cool Shield makes sense to shop around because they're selling their suits to other folks. So about these suits. A suit's a suit's a suit, right? Let's talk about the differences. First thing is zippers. Metal versus plastic. I would say there's pros and cons to both of these. YKK is the standard for zippers, metal. However, there's plastic suits that are plastic zippers on suits that work perfectly fine. And in fact, they're a lot smoother. And I don't know, I'm not adverse to this, as long as they're not cheap junk. Now, let me talk about the suit that I'm going to leave in Africa. When I first bought that suit, I picked it off the rack at a beekeeping meeting. And I put it on my table after purchasing it. And then at some point somebody said something to me about the jacket. And I went to put it on and found out the zipper was broken. It was plastic. I'm glad I found it out while I was at the show. And I walked it over and the brushy person exchanged it immediately for me. And that was very nice of them. By the way, I have a great experience with any of those companies. Brushy, Kelly, Dadont. And there is differences in the way that these suits are constructed. The mesh is different. While subtle, the mesh design and the fabrics differ from maker to maker. Some of the mesh has, well, let me first describe it, is there's a light nylon weave, open weave over top, and then there's this foamy style square shape check material in the middle, and then a nylon mesh smooth on the inside. So it's a three-layer fabric. The premise of these suits from design, as I understand it, is the three layers make it so deep that even if a bee did try to sting you, their stinger's not long enough to reach you. I will attest that as long as I've worn my suit, with an exception that I'll talk about in a second, I've never been stung through it, my Ultra Breeze. Now, the one thing I will say about this material is it's a bit bulky. If you bunch it up, it becomes very thick and, you know, if you're bending over. That's why with the excess material that I have, because my suit's too big, it feels even more bulky for me and why I want one that's the right size. Of course, every suit has features, pockets, enclosures, loops, cuffs. One of the things that I think is also the problem with my suit being that it's too big for me is it's too long. I could take the sleeves and put them out past my fingertips, and they still would be kind of bunched up on my arm. So when you buy a suit, you want to buy one that fits. The arms are the right length. And it just works. Now let me go back to the veils. The only time I ever got stung in my Ultra Breeze suit is with the veil, because I was looking down and the veil, I'm emulating this by holding my hand in front of my face, was touching my chin and the bee stung me through it. That'll happen in pretty much any suit. Now, what I've seen lately is they've been advancing designs of certain suits by adding features. You can unzip a veil or unzip the front and get to it, zip from the bottom. So if you're going to buy a suit, you either go the old school way of, I'm just going to buy this suit and it's going to be it, or you're going to really look through all the features and figure out what suits you. I mean, I saw one that had Velcro enclosures on the cuff that lets you enclose the cuff so that no bees could get up in. I think that's the Cool Shield one. And there's different designs on, say, the collar. Some have collars so that the Italian veil that I have, that I love, comes down and it bunches around a collar. But if you have a suit that has no collar and like a V-neck, and the reason that they make suits like that is if you have a veil that comes custom built with a suit, they run a zipper attachment from right about where your breastbone is all the way around the back of the suit and back through, and you zip to that zipper. If the entire neckline is inside the veil, you don't need a collar. It's just something to make you even hotter. So they omit the collar and you don't have that fabric in there. Now, some suits come with that zip line and a collar. So again, you have to look at the features of different sites, suits, and see what suits you, pun intended. So I'm not sure which one I'm going to choose yet. Still trying to figure out whether I want a telescoping hood or one of those hat style ones. The Ultra Breeze suit, which I love, is $163. It seems to me that everybody else has caught up to them. And I guess I have a question. What about a $55 eBay suit? Is it any good? I'm half tempted to buy one just to see whether it works or not. And what I think is that overseas, the people who make these sell them at cost and they get marked up after multiple distribution channels. And that's almost like buying it from the right person who made it in the first place. So I'll make my decision after I return and order a suit. I have to say I'm looking at the Cool Shield one right now as the leader. I did like the idea of Velcro enclosures and a couple other things. Let me come back to one other statement that I made. There was one suit that's $189. Why should a suit cost $189? If you go to custombsuits.com, you can get a Cool Shield suit, but they will literally build it to spec. And they have all the different measurements there. And if you're big and tall or somebody who has a different shape, you have a long body, short body, long legs, and you want to buy either a suit or a jumpsuit or whatever. By the way, I should be clear. What I've been looking at is jackets. I don't own a full-size hazmat-style suit. Although, one of these days, I have to buy one. I really should have one for the emergency team. Should we ever get called out for a bee spill emergency, you're supposed to have one of those, and I don't. I always thought maybe I'd wear my bunker pants from my fire department suit, because I know no bee could sting through those. But I digress. These were all for jackets that I was looking at. And that one website will build something to suit. And that's why the cost is so high. But I thought that was pretty interesting. So if you're a little bit different, this guy I work with, he has the longest torso of anybody I've ever seen. When he sits down, he still towers over everybody else. There's no suit that would ever fit him, as an example. So it's pretty interesting. Ventilated suits. What's your idea on this? Write me in. Tell me what you think of them if you have one. If you have one that I didn't mention that you particularly like. And I know that when I get to EAS and some of those things, I've been thinking about this idea. I'm thinking about buying a bunch of different one of these and do like an equipment review and then selling the suits or giving them away or doing something after I'm done. Anyway, that's just a concept that I've been thinking on lately. All right. Suits that suit you and are suitable. Okay, that's enough of that stuff. Topic number four, I call this one shop towels. I've been following Randy Oliver's work with distribution of oxalic acid via shop towels. I subscribe to his newsletter and would encourage you to. It's been a bit since I've had a time to circle back, and it looks like Randy is working on formulation experiments. Shared photos of his work experimenting and mixing different ratios of oxalic with glycerin and propylene glycol, which is used as a food-grade solvent. He reports that he's developed a method on how to discern how much oxalic is on the bees and factors of humidity and the abundant saturation on the towel is making, in his words, huge differences in whether the treatment hurts the bees. One might look at someone like Randy Oliver and wonder, this thing he's doing, it's a bit like product development. What are his credentials? Get me his papers. Hey, Kevin Moment, that's a nod to the Music Man for those who didn't get the cultural reference. Having met and spent a small amount of time with Randy, let me share this insight. What Randy does is probably the equivalent of a three-person team. I was left with an impression that he was always on kill when it comes to bees. I mean simply and utterly obsessed with bees. He has an energy that is unlike anyone I've seen, and I've seen some passionate people. The other thing about him was, through the proxy of his business that he and his children now oversee, as a commercial beekeeper, that made him a potent resource, and in some respects, and with no disrespect to researchers, a more practical person to tackle some of these problems, given his point of view about being neck deep into bees all the time and taking into account his background. He did it for profit, and sometimes that does actually make a difference.
That sounds kind of funny, so let me say this again. He was trying to make money, and everything he did had a purpose. I'm going to go down a bad place here, so I'll stop. But the bottom line is, let's just take it that he had a different approach, a different motivations. So how's he doing? He's progressing. I think he's getting closer to what is the right answer for this. I like the fact that, like our discussion, and incidentally I saw but didn't have a chance to read, he had something on lithium. He's cautioning people to be careful, right? You have to work through this. You shouldn't be out experimenting on your own with these things. So good for him on that. So I guess this is what I expected. It would take him a while to figure out the perfect recipe. And then his gift to everybody else is to share what his work is, you know, and fortunately people are supporting him. As an aside, he's a wealth of information, and I really need to go back and do some deep reading on his Varroa series. I followed it in dribs and drabs, but I think I need to go back, I mean really go back in one block and absorb his insights. And I'll share something with you. You could read something, and then you could read something for meaning. What was he writing? What was his train of thought? What was he trying to convey? Where was he going with what he was saying? There's a different thing about reading an article and then reading it and saying, what was the motivation of the author and what were they trying to teach me, tell me, show me? And you could read Randy's stuff, but every once in a while you have to stop and really look at what Randy's trying to teach. And if you follow his lessons from the beginning, one of the things I like about Randy is he has a linear narrative arc. You can almost see the way his mind is evolving and working through something. And that's why his series makes a lot of sense to me, because he builds on different concepts. Now, when you hear him talk in person after about the fifth minute, you're lost. And the good news about him is that he tends to be prolific in publishing. And if you hear him, you kind of pick up what his frame of thought is. And then you can go back and read it on your own accord. And again, read it for meeting. So in scanning the latest ones he put out there, there's some really insightful snippets. And it's a body of work that can't go ignored. You know, we need to be paying attention to what Randy's doing. If we want to know bees, we want to know Varroa. It has come to that. And as I've said before, I'm rooting for Randy and his research with oxalic. And I know that it takes time to find the right approach. But if anyone's going to figure this out, I'm guessing Randy seems to have been made for this. And the good news is he's semi-retired, is what I gather. His kids are taking over the business, and he can focus more attention on this. And he's giving even higher priorities to the energy of the things he's working on. So we're rooting for him. Thanks, Randy, for all you do. Topic number five is meetings. I'm going to share a little insight with you. It's 20 after 8, and I'm leaving for Malawi, and the car will be here to pick us up at 5:30. So I think I'm going to go short on this and have to carry this later. I will say that I'm going to share one snippet. Let me pick a meeting. The New Jersey Beekeepers Association two-day meeting, which turned out to be one day for us, but that's another story for a later day. The one speaker there was Larry Wiener. He's from Larry Wiener Landscape Associates. So what Larry spoke about is how to build a meadow for bees. And you always hear this, plant-friendly meadows, bee-friendly plants, bee-friendly meadow in a package kind of thing. But what Larry covered was really interesting. It was above and beyond all of the standard, this is a great plant for bees conversation. He discussed the lay of the land and that you can't just buy some package with a hippy-dippy approach and go out and spread it out and hope that you're going to have a meadow that's going to be meaningful in any given way. He systematically broke down what it takes to successfully, after a multi-year approach, transform a space into a meadow that is something that is good for pollinators or whatever its purpose may be. And his premise started with, obviously, soil. But it included things like habitation of what's there, how to change it out, whether you should or shouldn't till the land, that all fields probably have multi-diversity of soil, and you can't just expect to plant one thing. He talked about the competition of planting annuals and biannuals and layers to compete against weeding, but that there was no such thing as a weed-free landscape. It was still going to require some maintenance. It was just a really insightful talk. He broke it all down. It was a little nerdy towards the end, I would admit. Maybe I was zoned out, but fact of the matter is he presented a topic that I had never heard broken down in that way, and it makes far more sense to me. I hear folks say, oh, I'm going to go plant this thing. Well, I'll tell you right now, when I went and planted clover last year, just serendipity, bought a bag, went out, scratched the soil, put it in. Only about half of it came in. And everything outcompeted it. And I'm looking at it saying, I know I've done this wrong. There's got to be other reasons or approaches or ways, methods to make this happen. And in essence, what he gave was his expertise of how that works. So pretty interesting talk. I recorded it and he told me that I can post it. So at some point when I return, I will produce that and put it out on the YouTube channel for Northwest. And you'll be able to watch it and maybe get the same insights that I did. So beekeeping meetings, the season run is over. We probably won't get another really big beekeeping meeting till EAS in August for us. Although there is solicitation for someone to host some state meetings for New Jersey, and nobody's stepped up yet, so we don't know what that means. But all that aside, the Philadelphia meeting, this meeting, we did a meeting this week, this past week. I ended up doing a talk on treatments, and that you really do want to consider in New Jersey now, if you're of this ilk, a three-treatment season. One early to get the mites before the hive broods up, which means right now, March 1st. One in the time frame when you take your honey supers off and the mites could potentially overwhelm. And then, of course, towards the end of the year when you want to make sure that your bees are not impacted by mites when they're building overwinter bees. And that was a Northwest meeting for February. The March meeting, I found a colleague who is going to come in and do a microscope meeting. That's a first for us for Northwest, so I'm pretty excited about that. We went to the Raritan Valley Beekeepers Association meeting a week or so ago. I'm losing track of time at this juncture. Landy Simone was the featured speaker. She spoke about some talks that she's given in the past, but I've never seen. One of them was on record keeping, and the other one was on advanced topics of beekeeping. Both very good, and I brought my audio recorder. So I'll probably release those, with Landy's permission, as bonus episodes for you to listen to when I get back. So, holy cow, I have a ton of stuff to produce in no time. But I'll have enough things to keep us all occupied if we're so inclined for a long period of time. I guess one of the points of sharing all this with you is if you're not attending your beekeeping meetings from your local associations or your state associations or wherever you get your beekeeping content, you should. You're missing out. There's a lot of really good stuff that goes on. John Gott covered how to raise queens in his apiary. We've had John on the show before, and he's starting to build a new queen line for himself. He's really focused on gentle queens, and he literally took us through the entire process from start to finish of how he's cultivating queens for use in his apiary and to sell to locals up there where he is from. So, again, another really good talk, and I got it on video. So I have a lot of work to do to produce a bunch of these videos. Anyway, I said I was going to keep this short because I got three things to do before I turn in tonight. And I got to move along, folks. So I'll see if I could bring some more tidbits out of these meetings and less happenstance than I am. But forgive me, I'm going to keep going. Topic number six, geared up. I'm geared up mentally and physically for our trip to Malawi. I went today to see a neurologist who checked me out and said I've got a green light to go ahead and proceed with the flight. On the front of getting ready for the trip, truth be told, I'm usually a pretty organized person, but there's been an uneasiness about this trip around the logistics. I usually travel for work quite often, where Sharon puts our travel plans together. I guess I am learning firsthand that my type A personality makes me unsuitable for the fret-free approach to traveling. When I travel for work, I use the travel system that they have. I don't book it myself. And I'm pretty confident that I booked the flight correctly this time, but have gone over and over it again for fear of finding out that some stupid catastrophic event happens. I'm sorry, Mr. England, but you were booked on the flight yesterday. Have a nice day. At one point, especially around packing, I could not get my head around the details. So I did what any sane person would do and created a checklist. I've recently had a compulsion of being able to document what we're doing there. It's one of those underlying motivations for me personally for the trip. I want to be able to help and tell the story, which will help in a completely different way. I am grossly overpacked when it comes to the gear. But I am also uniquely ready to do any type of coverage. Video, audio, GoPro, macro shooting, anything that presents. I try to live my life with a philosophy that everything has its place and every place has its thing. Contrary to my mother, sorry, Mom, I somehow got an overabundance of the gene that drives obsessive compulsive organization. I am comfortable to share that I am so for the want of being organized that I am completely and utterly disorganized at many times. But given what I share about this podcast, I'm probably not telling you something that's a big revelation. In this trip, however, an organization coach would have given me an A+. I have one glitch in the system, though. My camera gear bag is heavy. I have never, on any flights that I've ever been on, been asked to weigh a carry-on bag. But this time, I understand that they may do it, and the carry-on bag is a ridiculous 18 pounds. And I'm guessing I'm going to end up paying the penalty. What I understand is the penalty is stiff here. But it's really no option for me. I'm packed, and I'm going to be Atlanta Brave, and I'm going to wander on the plane and hope that they don't weigh my stuff. So this trip is about beekeeping, but one thing I said to our state apiarist Tim Scholler is that if the opportunity ever presented, it would be my honor to help document the way things are there, to give visibility and tell the story. And I only hope that besides the beekeeping education we have to give when we're there, that this pans out in some way, some sort of fortune for the villages that we aim to help during our outreach. I went as far as repacking the bags a couple different times, and then finally I just put it all back. And I'll pay the piper if I have to, but that's the way it's going to go. So pay attention this week, facebook.com/beekeeperscorner, and hopefully I'll be able to post some things live while I'm there. There was a request for us to do a live broadcast at one point, but I'll find out the details when we get there, as I said in the opening. So as we come to the end of the topic, this is all I had prepared. I wanted to just do a couple ramblings. In preparation for the trip, I packed the hive and the honeybee. And I tried to set up the iPad to download American Bee Journal. I have no luck with that app. I bought it a long time ago to look at a Landy Simone article that was there, and I haven't looked at it since. But a couple times since then, I've tried to download it, meaning I subscribe to it. I've been paying for it ever since. And I tap on an article and it indicates, or the, not an article, an, wow, my brain is drawing a close, and that's only because I'm tired. Remember, the neurologist said I'm okay. One of the magazines, when I try to tap to download it, I can't get it to download, no matter what I do. I've uninstalled the app, put it back in. I'm not sure what the gist is there, but I'll try again before I go to bed, because I'd really like to read a couple of them on the plane. But if not, I'm going to unsubscribe and be done with this. Another thing that's on my mind is the weather. There's currently a nor'easter coming up the East Coast. We're supposed to fly out at 10:40 in the morning. And it doesn't look good. I'm hoping that flights don't get postponed and canceled and all that stuff. We were looking at a connection flight in Johannesburg, South Africa, that requires us to pretty much force our way through customs and get to the next plane, or we're going to miss it. And what we know about the flight schedules there is if we don't make that connection, we'll have to wait till Monday for the next flight, because they don't fly any the next couple days. So watching the weather with a little anxiety, but hoping that everything's going to work out. It would really suck for everything to turn sideways after all the planning that we've done for the trip. But nothing you could do about it, but get on the plane and go. So that's the way it's going to go. I learned of a sudden loss of a longtime listener to the podcast. And before I close out, I want to make note of that. John was a longtime supporter and contributor from way back in the catalog. He always used to send me all kinds of information, and I personally exchanged a number of emails with him about his beekeeping. So it was saddened to get an email from his wife sharing the news that he passed away unexpectedly. I can only wish the best for his family in these times of loss and would dedicate this episode in memory to him. Godspeed, John. And with that, I guess I'll close it out. We'll see you on the other side. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, and be well.